somebody, as yet unidentified by scholarship, went to great lengths to build raised fields on the newly exposed lands that had so recently been under the waters of the lake, a procedure which created characteristic corrugated strips of alternately high and low ground. It was not until the 1960s that the original function of these undulating patterns of earthen platforms and shallow canals was correctly worked out. Still visible today, and known as Waru Waru by the local Indians, they proved to be part of a complex agricultural design, perfected in prehistoric times, which had the ability to outperform modern farming techniques. In recent years, some of the raised fields were reconstructed by archaeologists and agronomists. These experimental plots consistently yielded 3 times more potatoes than even the most productive conventional plots. Likewise, during one particularly cold spell, a severe frost did little damage to the experimental fields. The following year, the crops on the elevated platform survived an equally ruinous drought, then later rode high and dry through a flood that swamped surrounding farmlands. Indeed, this simple but effective agricultural technique, invented by a culture so ancient that no one today could even remember its name, had proved such a success in rural Bolivia that it had attracted the attention of governmental and international development agencies and was now under test in several other parts of the world as well. An artificial language. Another possible legacy of Tiwanaku and of the Viracochas lay embedded in the language spoken by the local Aymara Indians, a language regarded by some specialists as the oldest in the world. In the 1980s, Ivan Guzman de Rojas, a Bolivian computer scientist, accidentally demonstrated that Aymara might be not only very ancient, but significantly, that it might be a made-up language, something deliberately and skillfully designed. Of particular note was the seemingly artificial character of its syntax, which was rigidly structured and unambiguous to an extent thought inconceivable in normal organic speech. This synthetic and highly organized structure meant that Aymara could easily be transformed into a computer algorithm to be used to translate one language into another. The Aymara algorithm is used as a bridge language. The language of an original document is translated into Aymara and then into any number of other languages. Was it just coincidence that an apparently artificial language, governed by a computer-friendly syntax, should be spoken today in the environs of Tiwanaku? Or could Aymara be a legacy of the high learning that legend attributed to the Viracochas? If so, what other legacies might there be? What other incomplete fragments of an old and forgotten wisdom might be lying scattered around? Fragments which had perhaps contributed to the richness and diversity of many of the cultures that had evolved in this region during the 10,000 years before the conquest. Perhaps it was the possession of fragments like these that had made possible the drawing of the Nazca lines and enabled the predecessors of the Incas to build the impossible stone walls at Machu Picchu and Sacsayhuaman. Mexico. The image I could not get out of my mind was of the Viracocha people leaving, walking on the waters of the Pacific Ocean, or going miraculously by sea, as so many of the legends told. Where had these seafarers been going? What had their objective been, and why, come to think of it, had they made such dogged efforts to stay in Tiwanaku for so long before admitting defeat and moving on? What had they been trying to achieve there that had been so important to them? After several weeks' work on the Altiplano, traveling back and forth between La Paz and Tiwanaku, it became clear that neither the otherworldly ruins nor the libraries of the capital were going to provide me with any further answers. Indeed, in Bolivia at least, the trail seemed to have gone cold. It was not until I reached Mexico, 2,000 miles to the north, that I picked up its traces again. Part 3. Plumed Serpent, Central America. Chapter 13. Blood and Time at the End of the World. Chichen Itza, Northern Yucatan, Mexico. Behind me, towering almost 100 feet into the air, was a perfect ziggurat, the Temple of Kukulcan. Its four stairways had 91 steps each. Taken together with the top platform, which counted as a further step, the total was 365. This gave the number of complete days in a solar year. In addition, the geometric design and orientation of the ancient structure had been calibrated with Swiss watch precision to achieve an objective as dramatic as it was esoteric. On the spring and autumn equinoxes, regular as clockwork, triangular patterns of light and shadow combined to create the illusion of a giant serpent undulating on the northern staircase. On each occasion, the illusion lasted for 3 hours and 22 minutes exactly. I walked away from the Temple of Kukulcan in an easterly direction. Ahead of me, starkly refuting the oft-repeated fallacy that the peoples of Central America had never succeeded in developing the column as an architectural feature, stood a forest of white stone columns, which must at one time have supported a massive roof. The sun was beating down harshly through the translucent blue of a cloudless sky, and the cool, deep shadows this area offered were alluring. I passed by, and made my way to the foot of the steep steps that led up to the adjacent Temple of the Warriors. At the top of these steps, becoming fully visible only after I'd begun to ascend them, was a giant figure. This was the idol of Shakmul. It half lay, half sat in an oddly stiff and expectant posture, bent knees protruding upwards, thick calves drawn back to touch its thighs, ankles tucked in against its buttocks, elbows planted on the ground, hands folded across its belly, encircling an empty plate, and its back set at an awkward angle as though it were just about to lever itself upright. Had it done so, I calculated, it would have stood about 8 feet tall. Even reclining, coiled and tightly sprung, it seemed to overflow with a fierce and pitiless energy. Its square features were thin-lipped and implacable, as hard and indifferent as the stone from which they were carved, and its eyes gazed westwards, traditionally the direction of darkness, death, and the color black. Rather lugubriously, I continued to climb the steps of the Temple of the Warriors. Weighing on my mind was the unforgettable fact that the ritual of human sacrifice had been routinely practiced here in pre-Columbian times. The empty plate that Shakmul held across his stomach had once served as a receptacle for freshly extracted hearts. If the victim's heart was to be taken out, reported one Spanish observer in the 16th century, they conducted him with great display and placed him on the sacrificial stone. Four of them took hold of his arms and legs, spreading them out. Then the executioner came, with a flint knife in his hand, and with great skill made an incision between the ribs on the left side, below the nipple. Then he plunged in his hand and, like a ravenous tiger, tore out the living heart, which he laid on the plate. What kind of culture could have nourished and celebrated such demonic behavior? Here in Chichen Itza, amid ruins dating back more than 1,200 years, a hybrid society had formed out of intermingled Maya and Toltec elements. This society was by no means exceptional in its addiction to cruel and barbaric ceremonies. On the contrary, all the great indigenous civilizations known to have flourished in Mexico had indulged in the ritualized slaughter of human beings. Slaughterhouses. Villa Hermosa, Tabasco Province. I stood looking at the altar of infant sacrifice. It was the creation of the Olmecs, the so-called mother culture of Central America, and it was more than 3,000 years old. A block of solid granite about 4 feet thick, its sides bore reliefs of four men wearing curious headdresses. Each man carried a healthy, chubby, struggling infant whose desperate fear was clearly visible. The back of the altar was undecorated. At the front, another figure was portrayed, holding in his arms, as though it were an offering, the slumped body of a dead child. The Olmecs are the earliest recognized high civilization of ancient Mexico, and human sacrifice was well established with them. 2,500 years later, at the time of the Spanish conquest, the Aztecs were the last, but by no means the least, of the peoples of this region to continue an extremely old and deeply ingrained tradition. They did so with fanatical zeal. It is recorded, for example, that Ahuizotl, the 8th and most powerful emperor of the Aztec royal dynasty, celebrated the dedication of the temple of Huitzilopochtli in Tenochtitlan by marshalling 4 lines of prisoners past teams of priests who worked 4 days to dispatch them. On this occasion, as many as 80,000 were slain during a single ceremonial rite. The Aztecs liked to dress up in the flayed skins of sacrificial victims. Bernardino de Sahagún, a Spanish missionary, attended one such ceremony soon after the conquest. The celebrants flayed and dismembered the captives. They then lubricated their own naked bodies with grease and slipped into the skin. Trailing blood and grease, the gruesomely clad men ran through the city, thus terrifying those they followed. The second day's rite also included a cannibal feast for each warrior's family. Another mass sacrifice was witnessed by the Spanish chronicler Diego de Durán. In this instance, the victims were so numerous that when the streams of blood running down the temple steps reached the bottom and cooled, they formed fat clots enough to terrify anyone. All in all, it has been estimated that the number of sacrificial victims in the Aztec Empire as a whole had risen to around 250,000 a year by the beginning of the 16th century. What was this manic destruction of human life for? According to the Aztecs themselves, it was done to delay the coming of the end of the world. Children of the Fifth Sun. Like the many different peoples and cultures that had preceded them in Mexico, the Aztecs believed that the universe operated in great cycles. The priests stated, as a matter of simple fact, that there had been 4 such cycles, or suns, since the creation of the human race. At the time of the conquest, it was the fifth sun that prevailed, and it is within that same fifth sun, or epoch, that humankind still lives today. This account is taken from a rare collection of Aztec documents, known as the Vaticano Latin Codex. First sun, Matlactli Atl, duration 4,008 years. Those who lived then ate water maize, called Atzitzintli. In this age lived the giants. The first sun was destroyed by water in the sign Matlactli Atl, 10 water. It was called Apacheo Hualitzli, flood, deluge, the art of sorcery, of the permanent rain. Men were turned into fish. Some say that only 1 couple escaped, protected by an old tree living near the water. Others say that there were 7 couples who hid in a cave until the flood was over and the waters had gone down. They repopulated the earth and were worshipped as gods in their nations. Second son, Ehecoatl, duration 4,010 years. Those who lived then ate wild fruit, known as Acotzintli. This sun was destroyed by Ehecoatl, wind serpent, and men were turned into monkeys. 1 man and 1 woman standing on a rock were saved from destruction. Third sun, Tlecuiahuilo, duration 4,081 years. Men, the descendants of the couple who were saved from the second sun, ate a fruit called Zincoacoc. This third sun was destroyed by fire. Fourth sun, Zontlilic, duration 5,026 years. Men died of starvation after a deluge of blood and fire. Another cultural document of the Aztecs that has survived the ravages of the conquest is the sunstone of Axayacatl, the 6th emperor of the royal dynasty. This huge monolith was hewn out of solid basalt in AD 1479. It weighs 24.5 tons and consists of a series of concentrically inscribed circles, each bearing intricate symbolic statements. As in the Codex, these statements focus attention on the belief that the world has already passed through 4 epochs or suns. The first and most remote of these is represented by Ocelotonatiuh, the jaguar god. During that sun, lived the giants that had been created by the gods but were finally attacked and devoured by jaguars. The second son is represented by the serpent head of Ehecoatl, the god of the air. During that period, the human race was destroyed by high winds and hurricanes, and men were converted into monkeys. The symbol of the third son is a head of rain and celestial fire. In this epoch, everything was destroyed by a rain of fire from the sky and the forming of lava. All houses were burnt. Men were converted into birds to survive the catastrophe. The fourth son is represented by the head of the water goddess, Chalchiutlicu. Destruction came in the form of torrential rains and floods. The mountains disappeared, and men were transformed into fish. The symbol of the fifth sun, our current epoch, is the face of Tonatiuh, the sun god himself. His tongue, fittingly depicted as an obsidian knife, juts out hungrily, signaling his need for the nourishment of human blood and hearts. His features are wrinkled to indicate his advanced age, and he appears within the symbol Olin, which signifies movement. Why is the fifth sun known as the sun of movement? Because, the elders say, in it there will be a movement of the earth, and from this we shall all perish. And when will this catastrophe strike? Soon, according to the Aztec priests. They believed that the fifth sun was already very old and approaching the end of its cycle, hence the wrinkles on the face of Tonatiuh. Ancient Mesoamerican traditions dated the birth of this epoch to the remote period corresponding to the 4th millennium BC of the Christian calendar. The method of calculating its end, however, had been forgotten by the time of the Aztecs. In the absence of this essential information, human sacrifices were apparently carried out in the hope that the impending catastrophe might be postponed. Indeed, the Aztecs came to regard themselves as a chosen people. They were convinced that they had been charged with a divine mission to wage war and offer the blood of their captives to feed Tonatiuh, thereby preserving the life of the fifth son. Stuart Feidel, an authority on the prehistory of the Americas, summed up the whole issue in these words. The Aztecs believed that to prevent the destruction of the universe, which had already occurred four times in the past, the gods must be supplied with a steady diet of human hearts and blood. This same belief, with remarkably few variations, was shared by all the great civilizations of Central America. Unlike the Aztecs, however, some of the earlier peoples had calculated exactly when a great movement of the earth could be expected to bring the fifth sun to an end. Lightbringer. No documents, only dark and menacing sculptures, have come down to us from the Olmec era. But the Mayas, justifiably regarded as the greatest ancient civilization to have arisen in the New World, left behind a wealth of calendrical records. Expressed in terms of the modern dating system, these enigmatic inscriptions convey a rather curious message. The fifth sun, it seems, has an expiry date. Somewhere around 21 December, the winter solstice, AD 2012. Despite the apparent precision, what was intended here was to signal an epoch of danger, extending roughly from 1960 to 2040, with the year 2012 in our calendar forming the rough center point. In the rational intellectual climate of our times, it is unfashionable to take doomsday prophecies seriously. The general consensus is that they are the products of superstitious minds and can safely be ignored. As I traveled around Mexico, however, I was from time to time bothered by a nagging intuition that the voices of the ancient sages might deserve a hearing after all. I mean, suppose by some crazy off chance they weren't the superstitious savages we'd always believed them to be. Suppose they knew something we didn't. Most pertinent of all, suppose that their projected date for the end of the fifth sun turned out to be correct. Suppose, in other words, that some truly awful geological catastrophe is already unfolding deep in the bowels of the earth, as the wise men of the Maya predicted. In Peru and Bolivia, I had become aware of the obsessive concern with the calculation of time shown by the Incas and their predecessors. Now in Mexico, I discovered that the Maya, who believed that they had worked out the date of the end of the world, had been possessed by the same compulsion. Indeed, for these people, just about everything boiled down to numbers, the passage of the years and the manifestations of events. The belief was that if the numbers which lay beneath the manifestations could be properly understood, it would be possible to predict successfully the timing of the events themselves. I felt disinclined to ignore the obvious implications of the recurrent destructions of humanity depicted so vividly in Central American traditions. Coming complete with giants and floods, these traditions were eerily similar to those of the far-off Andean region. Meanwhile, however, I was keen to pursue another, related line of inquiry. This concerned the bearded, white-skinned deity named Quetzalcoatl, who was believed to have sailed to Mexico from across the seas in remote antiquity. Quetzalcoatl was credited with the invention of the advanced mathematical and calendrical formulae that the Maya were later to use to calculate the date of doomsday. He also bore a striking resemblance to Viracocha, the pale god of the Andes, who came to Tiwanaku in the time of darkness, bearing the gifts of light and civilization. Chapter 14. People of the Serpent. After spending so long immersed in the traditions of Viracocha, the bearded god of the distant Andes, I was intrigued to discover that Quetzalcoatl, the principal deity of the ancient Mexican pantheon, was described in terms that were extremely familiar. For example, one pre-Columbian myth collected in Mexico by the 16th century Spanish chronicler Juan de Torquemada asserted that Quetzalcoatl was a fair and ruddy-complexioned man with a long beard. Another spoke of him as era hombre blanco, a large man, broad-browed, with huge eyes, long hair, and a great, rounded beard, la barba grande y redonda. Another still described him as a mysterious person, a white man with strong formation of body, broad forehead, large eyes, and a flowing beard. He was dressed in a long white robe reaching to his feet. He condemned sacrifices, except of fruits and flowers, and was known as the god of peace. When addressed on the subject of war, he is reported to have stopped up his ears with his fingers. According to a particularly striking Central American tradition, this wise instructor came from across the sea in a boat that moved by itself without paddles. He was a tall, bearded white man who taught people to use fire for cooking. He also built houses and showed couples that they could live together as husband and wife, and since people often quarreled in those days, he taught them to live in peace. Viracocha's Mexican Twin. The listener will recall that Viracocha, in his journeys through the Andes, went by several different aliases. Quetzalcoatl did this too. In some parts of Central America, notably among the Quiche Maya, he was called Cucumatz. Elsewhere, at Chichen Itza, for example, he was known as Kukulkan. When both these words were translated into English, they turned out to mean exactly the same thing, plumed or feathered serpent. This was also the meaning of Quetzalcoatl. There were other deities, among the Maya in particular, whose identities seemed to merge closely with those of Quetzalcoatl. One was Votan, a great civilizer, who was also described as pale-skinned, bearded, and wearing a long robe. Scholars could offer no translation for his name, but his principal symbol, like that of Quetzalcoatl, was a serpent. Another closely related figure was Itamana, the Mayan god of healing, who was a robed and bearded individual. His symbol, too, was the rattlesnake. What emerged from all this, as the leading authorities agreed, was that the Mexican legends collected and passed on by Spanish chroniclers at the time of the conquest were often the confused and conflated products of extremely long oral traditions. Behind them all, however, it seems that there must lie some solid historical reality. In the judgment of Sylvanus Griswold Morley, the doyen of Maya studies, the great god Kukulkan, or feathered serpent, was the Mayan counterpart of the Aztec Quetzalcoatl, the Mexican god of light, learning, and culture. In the Maya pantheon, he was regarded as having been the great organizer, the founder of cities, the former of laws, and the teacher of the calendar. Indeed, his attributes and life history are so human that it is not improbable that he may have been an actual historical character, some great lawgiver and organizer, the memory of whose benefactions lingered long after his death, and whose personality was eventually deified. All the legends stated unambiguously that Quetzalcoatl, Kukulcan, Gucumatz, Votan, Itzamana had arrived in Central America from somewhere very far away, across the Eastern Sea, and that amid great sadness he had eventually sailed off again in the direction whence he had come. The legends added that he had promised solemnly that he would return one day. A clear echo of Viracocha, it would be almost perverse to ascribe to coincidence. In addition, it will be recalled that Viracocha's departure across the waves of the Pacific Ocean had been portrayed in the Andean traditions as a miraculous event. Quetzalcoatl's departure from Mexico also had a strange feel about it, for he was said to have sailed away on a raft of serpents. All in all, I felt Morley was right in looking for a factual historical background behind the Mayan and Mexican myths. What the tradition seemed to indicate was that the bearded, pale-skinned foreigner called Quetzalcoatl, or Kukulcan, or whatever, had been not just one person, but probably several people, who had come from the same place and had belonged to the same distinctively non-Indian ethnic type, bearded, white-skinned, etc. This wasn't only suggested by the existence of a family of obviously related but slightly different gods sharing the symbol of the snake. Quetzalcoatl, Kukulcan, Itzamana was quite explicitly portrayed in many of the Mexican and Mayan accounts as having been accompanied by attendants or assistants. Certain myths set out in the ancient Mayan religious texts, known as the Books of Chilambalam, for instance, reported that the first inhabitants of Yucatan were the people of the serpent. They came from the east in boats across the water with their leader Itzamana, Serpent of the East, a healer who could cure by laying on hands and who revived the dead. Kukulcan, stated another tradition, came with 19 companions, two of whom were gods of fish, two others gods of agriculture, and a god of thunder. They stayed 10 years in Yucatan. Kukulcan made wise laws, and then set sail and disappeared in the direction of the rising sun. According to the Spanish chronicler Las Casas, the natives affirmed that in ancient times there came to Mexico 20 men, the chief of whom was called Kukulcan. They wore flowing robes and sandals on their feet. They had long beards and their heads were bare. Kukulcan instructed the people in the arts of peace and caused various important edifices to be built. Meanwhile, Juan de Torquemada recorded this very specific pre-conquest tradition concerning the imposing strangers who had entered Mexico with Quetzalcoatl. They were men of good carriage, well-dressed, in long robes of black linen, open in front and without capes, cut low at the neck, with short sleeves that did not come to the elbow. These followers of Quetzalcoatl were men of great knowledge and cunning artists in all kinds of fine work. Like some long-lost twin of Viracocha, the white and bearded Andean deity, Quetzalcoatl was depicted as having brought to Mexico all the skills and sciences necessary to create a civilized life, thus ushering in a golden age. He was believed, for example, to have introduced the knowledge of writing to Central America, to have invented the calendar, and to have been a master builder who taught the people the secrets of masonry and architecture. He was the father of mathematics, metallurgy, and astronomy, and was said to have measured the earth. He also founded productive agriculture, and was reported to have discovered and introduced corn, literally the staff of life in these ancient lands. A great doctor and master of medicines, he was the patron of healers and diviners, and disclosed to the people the mysteries of the properties of plants. In addition, he was revered as a lawgiver, as a protector of craftsmen, and as a patron of all the arts. As might be expected of such a refined and cultured individual, he forbade the grisly practice of human sacrifice during the period of his ascendancy in Mexico. After his departure, the blood-spattered rituals were reintroduced with a vengeance. Nevertheless, even the Aztecs, the most vehement sacrificers ever to have existed in the long history of Central America, remembered the time of Quetzalcoatl with a kind of nostalgia. He was a teacher, recalled one legend, who taught that no living thing was to be harmed, and that sacrifices were to be made not of human beings, but of birds and butterflies. Cosmic struggle. Why did Quetzalcoatl go away? What went wrong? Mexican legends provided answers to these questions. They said that the enlightened and benevolent rule of the plumed serpent had been brought to an end by Tezcatlipoca, a malevolent god whose name meant smoking mirror and whose cult demanded human sacrifice. It seemed that a near cosmic struggle between the forces of light and darkness had taken place in ancient Mexico, and that the forces of darkness had triumphed. The supposed stage for these events, now known as Tula, was not believed to be particularly old, not much more than 1,000 years anyway, but the legends surrounding it linked it to an infinitely more distant epoch. In those times, outside history, it had been known as Tolan. All the traditions agreed that it had been at Tolan that Tezcatlipoca had vanished Quetzalcoatl and forced him to quit Mexico. Fire serpents. Tula, Hidalgo province. I was sitting on the flat square summit of the unimaginatively named Pyramid B. The late afternoon sun was beating down out of a clear blue sky, and I was facing south, looking around. At the base of the pyramid, to the north and east, were murals depicting jaguars and eagles feasting on human hearts. Immediately behind me were ranged 4 pillars and 4 fearsome granite idols, each 9 feet tall. Ahead and to my left lay the partially unexcavated Pyramid C, a cactus-covered mound about 40 feet high. And further away were more mounds, not yet investigated by archaeologists. To my right was a ball court. In that long, eye-shaped arena, terrible gladiatorial games had been staged in ancient times. Teams, or sometimes just 2 individuals pitted against each other, would compete for possession of a rubber ball. The losers were decapitated. The idols on the platform behind me had a solemn and intimidating aura. I stood up to look at them more closely. Their sculptor had given them hard, implacable faces, hooked noses and hollow eyes, and they seemed without sympathy or emotion. What interested me most, however, was not so much their ferocious appearance as the objects that they clutched in their hands. Archaeologists admitted that they didn't really know what these objects were, but had tentatively identified them anyway. This identification had stuck, and it was now received wisdom that spear throwers, called atlatls, were held in the right hands of the idols, and spears or arrows and incense bags in the left hands. It didn't seem to matter that the objects did not in any way resemble atlatls, spears, arrows, or incense bags. As I studied the objects themselves, I had the distinct sense that they were meant to represent devices which had originally been made out of metal. The right-hand device, which seemed to emerge from a sheath or handguard, was lozenge-shaped, with a curved lower edge. The left-hand device could have been an instrument or weapon of some kind. I remembered legends which related that the gods of ancient Mexico had armed themselves with Zihuacoatl, fire serpents. These apparently emitted burning rays, capable of piercing and dismembering human bodies. Was it fire serpents that the Tula idols were holding? What, for that matter, were fire serpents? Whatever they were, both devices looked like pieces of technology, and both in certain ways resembled the equally mysterious objects in the hands of the idols in the Calasasilla at Tiwanaku. Serpent Sanctuary. Santa and I had come to Tula Tolan because it had been closely associated both with Quetzalcoatl and with his arch-enemy, Tezcatlipoca, the Smoking Mirror. Ever young, omnipotent, omnipresent, and omniscient, Tezcatlipoca was associated in the legends with night, darkness, and the sacred jaguar. He was invisible and implacable, appearing to men sometimes as a flying shadow, sometimes as a dreadful monster. Often depicted as a glaring skull, he was said to have been the owner of a mysterious object, the Smoking Mirror, after which he was named, which he made use of to observe from afar the activities of men and gods. Scholars quite reasonably suppose that it must have been a primitive obsidian scrying stone. Obsidian had an especial sanctity for the Mexicans, as it provided the sacrificial knives employed by the priests. The Spanish chronicler Bernal Diaz states that they called this stone Tezcat. From it mirrors were also manufactured as divinatory media to be used by wizards. Representing the forces of darkness and rapacious evil, Tezcatlipoca was said in the legends to have been locked in a conflict with Quetzalcoatl that had continued over an immense span of years. At certain times, one seemed to be gaining the upper hand, at certain times the other. Finally, the cosmic struggle came to an end when good was vanquished by evil, and Quetzalcoatl driven out from Tolan. Thereafter, under the influence of Tezcatlipoca's nightmarish cult, human sacrifice was reintroduced throughout Central America. As we have seen, Quetzalcoatl was believed to have fled to the coast and to have been carried away on a raft of serpents. One legend says he burned his houses built of silver and shells, buried his treasure, and set sail on the eastern sea, preceded by his attendants who had been changed into bright birds. This poignant moment of departure was supposedly staged at a place called Coatzacoalcos, meaning serpent sanctuary. There, before taking his leave, Quetzalcoatl promised his followers he would return one day, to overthrow the cult of Tezcatlipoca, and to inaugurate an era when the gods would again accept sacrifices of flowers and cease their clamor for human blood. Chapter 15. Mexican Babel. We drove southeast from Tula, bypassing Mexico City on an anarchic series of fast freeways that dragged us through the creeping edge of the capital's eye-watering, lung-searing pollution. Our route then took us up over pine-covered mountains, past the snowy peak of Popocatapetl, and thence along tree-lined lanes amid fields and farmsteads. In the late afternoon, we arrived at Cholula, a sleepy town with 11,000 inhabitants and a spacious main square. After turning east through the narrow streets, we crossed a railway line and pulled to a halt in the shadow of Tlachicualtepetl, the man-made mountain we had come here to see. Once sacred to the peaceful cult of Quetzalcoatl, but now surmounted by an ornate Catholic church, this immense edifice was ranked among the most extensive and ambitious engineering projects ever undertaken anywhere in the ancient world. Indeed, with a base area of 45 acres and a height of 210 feet, it was three times more massive than the Great Pyramid of Egypt. Though its contours were now blurred by age and its sides overgrown with grass, it was still possible to recognize that it had once been an imposing ziggurat, which had risen up towards the heavens in four clean-angled steps. Measuring almost half a kilometer along each side at its base, it had also succeeded in preserving a dignified but violated beauty. The past, though often dry and dusty, is rarely dumb. Sometimes it can speak with passion. It seemed to me that it did so here, bearing witness to the physical and psychological degradation visited upon the native peoples of Mexico when the Spanish conquistador, Hernán Cortés, almost casually beheaded a culture as a passerby might sweep off the head of a sunflower. In Cholula, a great center of pilgrimage with a population of around 100,000 at the time of the conquest, this decapitation of ancient traditions and ways of life required that something particularly humiliating be done to the man-made mountain of Quetzalcoatl. The solution was to smash and desecrate the temple, which had once stood on the summit of the ziggurat, and replace it with a church. Cortés and his men were few, the Cholulans were many. When they marched into town, however, the Spaniards had one major advantage. Bearded and pale-skinned, dressed in shining armor, they looked like the fulfillment of a prophecy. Had it not always been promised that Quetzalcoatl, the plumed serpent, would return from across the eastern sea with his band of followers? Because of this expectation, the naive and trusting Cholulans permitted the conquistadors to climb the steps of the ziggurat and enter the great courtyard of the temple. Bare troops of gaily bedecked dancing girls greeted them, singing and playing on instruments, while stewards moved back and forth with heaped platters of bread and delicate cooked meats. One of the Spanish chroniclers, an eyewitness to the events that followed, reported that the adoring townsfolk of all ranks, unarmed, with eager and happy faces, crowded in to hear what the white men would say. Realizing from this incredible reception that their intentions were not suspected, the Spaniards closed and guarded all the entrances, drew their weapons of steel, and murdered their hosts. 6,000 died in this horrible massacre, which matched in its savagery the most blood-stained rituals of the Aztecs. Those of Cholula were caught unawares. With neither arrows nor shields did they meet the Spaniards. Just so, they were slain without warning. They were killed by pure treachery. It was ironic, I thought, that the conquistadors in both Peru and Mexico should have benefited in the same way from local legends that prophesied the return of a pale, bearded god. If that god was indeed a deified human, as seemed likely, he must have been a person of high civilization and exemplary character, or more probably, two different people from the same background, one working in Mexico and providing the model for Quetzalcoatl, the other in Peru being the model for Viracocha. The superficial resemblance that the Spanish bore to those earlier fair-skinned foreigners opened many doors that would otherwise certainly have been closed. Unlike their wise and benevolent predecessors, however, Pizarro in the Andes and Cortés in Central America were ravening wolves. They ate up the lands and the peoples and the cultures they had seized upon. They destroyed almost everything. Tears for the past. Their eyes scaled with ignorance, bigotry, and greed, the Spanish erased a precious heritage of mankind when they arrived in Mexico. In so doing, they deprived the future of any detailed knowledge concerning the brilliant and remarkable civilizations which once flourished in Central America. What, for example, was the true history of the glowing idol that rested in a sacred sanctuary in the Mixtec capital at Yotlan? We know of this curious object through the writings of a 16th century eyewitness, Father Burgoa. The material was of marvelous value, for it was an emerald of the size of a thick pepper pod, upon which a small bird was engraved with the greatest skill, and with the same skill a small serpent coiled ready to strike. The stone was so transparent that it shone from its interior with the brightness of a candle flame. It was a very old jewel, and there is no tradition concerning the origin of its veneration and worship. What might we learn if we could examine this very old jewel today? And how old was it really? We shall never find out, because Father Benito, the first missionary of Achiotlan, seized the stone from the Indians. He had it ground up, although a Spaniard offered 3,000 ducats for it, stirred the powder in water, poured it upon the earth, and trod upon it. Equally typical of the profligate squandering of the intellectual riches concealed in the Mexican past was the shared fate of two gifts given to Cortés by the Aztec Emperor Montezuma. These were circular calendars, as big as cartwheels, one of solid silver and the other of solid gold. Both were elaborately engraved with beautiful hieroglyphs, which may have contained material of great interest. Cortés had them melted down for ingots on the spot. More systematically, all over Central America, vast repositories of knowledge accumulated since ancient times were painstakingly gathered, heaped up, and burned by zealous friars. In July 1562, for example, in the main square of Mani, just south of modern Mérida in Yucatán province, Father Diego de Landa burned thousands of Maya codices, story paintings, and hieroglyphs inscribed on rolled-up deerskins. He also destroyed countless idols and altars, all of which he described as works of the devil, designed by the evil one to delude the Indians and to prevent them from accepting Christianity. Elsewhere, he elaborated on the same theme. We found great numbers of books written in the characters of the Indians, but as they contained nothing but superstitions and falsehoods of the devil, we burned them all, which the natives took most grievously, and which gave them great pain. Not only the natives should have felt this pain, but anyone and everyone then and now who would like to know the truth about the past. Many other men of God, some even more ruthlessly efficient than Diego de Landa, participated in Spain's satanic mission to wipe clear the memory banks of Central America. Notable among these was Juan de Zumarraga, Bishop of Mexico, who boasted of having destroyed 20,000 idols and 500 Indian temples. In November 1530, he burned a Christianized Aztec aristocrat at the stake for having allegedly reverted to worship of the rain god, and later, in the marketplace at Texcoco, built a vast bonfire of astronomical documents, paintings, manuscripts, and hieroglyphic texts which the conquistadors had forcibly extracted from the Aztecs during the previous 11 years. As this irreplaceable storehouse of knowledge and history went up in flames, a chance to shake off at least some of the collective amnesia that clouds our understanding was lost to mankind forever. What remains to us of the written records of the ancient peoples of Central America? The answer, thanks to the Spanish, is less than 20 original codices and scrolls. We know from hearsay that many of the documents which the friars reduced to ashes contained records of ages past. What did these lost records say? What secrets did they hold? Gigantic men of deformed stature. Even while the orgy of book burning was still going on, some Spaniards began to realize that a truly great civilization had once existed in Mexico prior to the Aztecs. Oddly enough, one of the first to act on this realization was Diego de Landa. He appears to have undergone a Damascus Road experience after staging his auto da fe at Mani. In later years, determined to save what he could of the ancient wisdom he had once played such a large part in destroying, he became an assiduous gatherer of the traditions and oral histories of the native peoples of the Yucatan. Bernardino de Sahagún, a Franciscan friar, was a chronicler to whom we owe much. A great linguist, he is reported to have sought out the most learned and often the oldest natives and asked each to paint in his Aztec picture writing as much as he could clearly remember of Aztec history, religion, and legend. In this way, Sahagún was able to accumulate detailed information on the anthropology, mythology, and social history of ancient Mexico, which he later set down in a learned 12-volume work. This was suppressed by the Spanish authorities. Fortunately, one copy has survived, though it is incomplete. Diego de Durán, a conscientious and courageous collector of indigenous traditions, was yet another Franciscan who fought to recover the lost knowledge of the past. He visited Cholula in AD 1585, a time of rapid and catastrophic change. There he interviewed a venerated elder of the town, said to have been more than 100 years old, who told him this story about the making of the great ziggurat. In the beginning, before the light of the sun had been created, this place, Cholula, was in obscurity and darkness. All was a plain, without hill or elevation, encircled in every part by water, without tree or created thing. Immediately after the light and the sun arose in the east, there appeared gigantic men of deformed stature who possessed the land. Enamored of the light and beauty of the sun, they determined to build a tower so high that its summit should reach the sky. Having collected materials for the purpose, they found a very adhesive clay and bitumen with which they speedily commenced to build the tower, and having reared it to the greatest possible altitude, so that it reached the sky, the Lord of the heavens, enraged, said to the inhabitants of the sky, "Have you observed how they of the earth have built a high and haughty tower to mount hither, being enamored of the light of the sun and his beauty? Come and confound them, because it is not right that they of the earth, living in the flesh, should mingle with us." Immediately, the inhabitants of the sky sallied forth like flashes of lightning. They destroyed the edifice and divided and scattered its builders to all parts of the earth. It was this story, almost but not quite the biblical account of the Tower of Babel, which was itself a reworking of a far older Mesopotamian tradition, that had brought me to Cholula. Central American and Middle Eastern tales were obviously closely related. Indeed, the similarities were unmissable. But there were also differences far too significant to be ignored. Of course, the similarities could be due to unrecorded pre-Columbian contacts between the cultures of the Middle East and the New World. But there was one way to explain the similarities and the differences in a single theory. Suppose that the two versions of the legend had evolved separately for several thousands of years, but prior to that, both had descended from the same remotely ancient ancestor. Remnants. Here's what the book of Genesis says about the tower that reached to heaven. Throughout the earth, men spoke the same language with the same vocabulary. Now as they moved eastwards, they found a plain in the land of Shinar where they settled. There they said to one another, "Come, let us make bricks and bake them in the fire." For stone they used bricks and for mortar they used bitumen. "Come," they said, "let us build ourselves a town and a tower with its top reaching heaven. Let us make a name for ourselves so that we may not be scattered about the entire earth." Now Yahweh, the Hebrew God, came down to see the town and the tower that the sons of man had built. "So they are all a single people with a single language," said Yahweh. "This is but the start of their undertakings. There will be nothing too hard for them to do. Come, let us go down and confuse their language on the spot, so that they can no longer understand one another." Yahweh scattered them thence over the whole face of the earth, and they stopped building the tower. It was named Babel, therefore, because there Yahweh confused the language of the whole earth. The verse which most interested me suggested very clearly that the ancient builders of the Tower of Babel had set out to create a lasting monument to themselves so that their name would not be forgotten, even if their civilization and language were. Was it possible that the same considerations could have applied at Cholula? Only a handful of monuments in Mexico were thought by archaeologists to be more than 2,000 years old. Cholula was definitely one of them. Indeed, no one could say for sure in what distant age its ramparts had first begun to be heaped up. For thousands of years before development and extension of the site began in earnest around 300 BC, it looked as though some other, older structure might have been positioned at the spot over which the great ziggurat of Quetzalcoatl now rose. There was a precedent for this, which further strengthened the intriguing possibility that the remnants of a truly ancient civilization might still be lying around in Central America, waiting to be recognized. For example, just south of the university campus of Mexico City, off the main road connecting the capital to Cuernavaca, stands a circular step pyramid of great complexity, with four galleries and a central staircase. It was partially excavated in the 1920s from beneath a mantle of lava. Geologists were called to the site to help date the lava and carried out a detailed examination. To everyone's surprise, they concluded that the volcanic eruption, which had completely buried three sides of this pyramid, and then gone on to cover about 60 square miles of the surrounding territory, must have taken place at least 7,000 years ago. This geological evidence seems to have been ignored by historians and archaeologists who do not believe that any civilization capable of building a pyramid could have existed in Mexico at such an early date. It is worth noting, however, that Byron Cummings, the American archaeologist who originally excavated the site for the National Geographical Society, was convinced by clearly demarcated stratification layers above and below the pyramid, laid down both before and after the volcanic eruption, that it was the oldest temple yet uncovered on the American continent. He went further than the geologists and stated categorically that this temple fell into ruins some 8,500 years ago. Pyramids upon pyramids. Going inside the Cholula pyramid really did feel like entering a man-made mountain. The tunnels, and there were more than 6 miles of them, were not old. They had been left behind by the teams of archaeologists who had burrowed here diligently from 1931 until funds ran out in 1966. Somehow, these narrow, low-ceilinged corridors had borrowed an atmosphere of antiquity from the vast structure all around them. Moist and cool, they offered an inviting and secretive darkness. Following a ribbon of torchlight, we walked deeper inside the pyramid. The archaeological excavations had revealed that it was not the product of one dynasty, as was thought to have been the case with the pyramids of Giza in Egypt, but that it had been built up over a very long period of time, 2,000 years or so at a conservative estimate. In other words, it was a collective project created by an intergenerational labor force drawn from the many different cultures, Olmec, Teotihuacan, Toltec, Zapotec, Mixtec, Cholulan, and Aztec, that had passed through Cholula since the dawn of civilization in Mexico. Though it was not known who had been the first builders here, as far as it had been possible to establish, the earliest major edifice on the site consisted of a tall, conical pyramid shaped like an upturned bucket, flattened at the summit where a temple had stood. Much later, a second, similar structure was imposed on top of this primordial mound. In other words, a second inverted bucket of clay and compacted stone was placed directly over the first, raising the temple platform to more than 200 feet above the surrounding plain. Thereafter, during the next 1,500 years or so, an estimated 4 or 5 other cultures contributed to the final appearance of the monument. This they did by extending its base in several stages, but never again by increasing its maximum height. In this way, almost as though a master plan were being implemented, the man-made mountain of Cholula gradually attained its characteristic 4-tier ziggurat shape. Today, its sides at the base are each almost 1,500 feet long, about twice the length of the sides of the Great Pyramid at Giza. And its total volume has been estimated at a staggering 3 million cubic meters. This makes it, as one authority succinctly states, the largest building ever erected on Earth. Why? Why go to all that trouble? And what sort of name for themselves were the peoples of Central America trying to make? Walking through the network of corridors and passageways, inhaling the cool, loamy air, I was uncomfortably conscious of the great weight and mass of the pyramid pressing down upon me. It was the largest building in the world, and it had been placed here in honor of a Central American deity of whom almost nothing was known. We had the conquistadors and the Catholic Church to thank for leaving us so deeply in the dark about the true story of Quetzalcoatl and his followers, the smashing and desecration of his ancient temple at Cholula, the destruction of idols, altars, and calendars, and the great bonfires made out of codices, paintings, and hieroglyphic scrolls had succeeded almost completely in silencing the voices of the past. But the legends did offer us one graphic and powerful piece of imagery, a memory of the gigantic men of deformed stature who were said to have been the original builders. Chapter 16. Serpent Sanctuary. From Cholula, we drove east, past the prosperous cities of Puebla, Orizaba, and Cordoba, towards Veracruz and the Gulf of Mexico. We crossed the mist-enshrouded peaks of the Sierra Madre Oriental, where the air was thin and cold, and then descended towards sea level, onto tropical plains, overgrown with lush plantations of palms and bananas. We were heading into the heartlands of Mexico's oldest and most mysterious civilization, that of the so-called Olmecs, whose name meant rubber people. Dating back to the second millennium BC, the Olmecs had ceased to exist 1,500 years before the rise of the Aztec Empire. The Aztecs, however, had preserved haunting traditions concerning them and were even responsible for naming them after the rubber-producing area of Mexico's Gulf Coast, where they were believed to have lived. This area lies between modern Veracruz in the west and Ciudad del Carmen in the east. In it, the Aztecs found a number of ancient ritual objects produced by the Olmecs, and for reasons unknown, they collected these objects and placed them in positions of importance in their own temples. Looking at my map, I could see the blue line of the Coatzacoalcos River running into the Gulf of Mexico, more or less at the midpoint of the legendary Olmec homeland. The oil industry proliferates here now, where rubber trees once flourished, transforming a tropical paradise into something resembling the lowest circle of Dante's Inferno. Since the oil boom of 1973, the town of Coatzacoalcos, once easygoing but not very prosperous, had mushroomed into a transport and refining center with air-conditioned hotels and a population of 500,000. It lay close to the black heart of an industrial wasteland in which virtually everything of archaeological interest that had escaped the depredations of the Spanish at the time of the conquest had been destroyed by the voracious expansion of the oil business. It was therefore no longer possible, on the basis of hard evidence, to